The Nagging. Naturalist. It's the Nagging Naturalist Podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Nagging Naturalist Podcast. This podcast discusses animals, how they benefit our society and our planet, the threats they face, and what we can do to protect them. I'm your host, Kristen, and I'm a naturalist by trade. Normally, we would be doing an animal of the month at this point, but this month I'm actually doing a takeover where I let different wildlife experts take over my podcast and basically discuss the things that they want to talk about, whether they're wildlife related or not. Today's takeover is actually going to be a two-part takeover because we went a little over our time, but there were a lot of things that she wanted to discuss, and the entire point of me doing this takeover was to let the people who were taking over voice the things that they wanted to voice, and to be honest, it was just really easy talking to her, and there was a lot of venting. So I hope you guys enjoy this. It will be, like I said, two parts. I'm going to release... This first part is being released on We Out Here, which is part of Black Mammalogist Week. And then the second part will be coming out on Forage Friday. So be sure to keep an eye out for that and catch those. And also make sure that you are following Black Mammalogist Week as well, because I'm pretty sure we plug it, but that's in part two, which is coming out Friday. So I wanted to make sure that I made plugs for that now, because for now you're just going to get a big old rant from us. Also, I should give a bit of a heads up. This is going to be one of my first podcasts that is going to be not safe for work. So it's not like it's full of cursing or anything like that, but there are some times when my guest is very vocal in her feelings. And I felt like with the way that we discuss issues like tone policing, that it wouldn't really be appropriate to censor her, especially when I told her that she was going to be allowed to do what she wanted and say what she wanted. So I'm going to leave those parts in, but I did want to give that heads up. I will, of course, when I upload these episodes, be marking them as not safe for work. And honestly, it's really not that bad. It's just a couple instances here and there, but I did want to give that general heads up. So anyway, hope you guys enjoy this. And joining me today is Rhiannon Curtin. She is a cervidologist, which is a scientist who studies deer. And if you are not familiar with her background, I would actually highly recommend the ologies episode she did with another Rhiannon, who also happened to be a cervidologist. It's a really great way to learn about the work she does and some of the conservation issues surrounding deer. But for this episode, she's going to be discussing a very different type of topic. And so thank you so much for joining me, Rhiannon, and for offering us your knowledge and expertise on these particular topics that you're going to discuss today.
Thank you for having me. I don't think I'm an expert, but I'm happy to share with people what I'm learning as I am going along and learning more about my history and the history of Black folks in North America. I'm not from North America. I was born in the UK, but my dad's family are Jamaican, and so they shared in this history of the transatlantic slave trade. And so people were brought across to Jamaica in the same way they were brought to the United States and to Canada. So the history is intertwined way back when, and it's really interesting for me as someone who shares that history to now be living in Canada and to learn more about this history that has largely been erased from the popular narrative. I don't know why that is. I could take some guesses, but I am all about uncovering this hidden history that exists here of Black folks across Canada. And I think often when people think of Black people in Canada, they think of like, oh, Toronto, because there is a huge Black population in Toronto. And we have the Carabana Festival every year on Emancipation Day. But Black people have existed across Canada for a long, long time. and they settled the Canadian prairies, and they were cowboys, and they were fur traders, and they were hunters. And yet, when you watch a cowboy movie, don't recommend, they're usually terrible, but if you do, then you often will see, you know, a guy with dirty blonde hair and blue eyes. And when you open a hunting magazine, I have never seen a black hunter in a hunting magazine. And so it's really interesting to me that we did exist in these communities and you don't hear about it. And especially now when we're talking about representation and how much representation matters and the people, you know, you don't want to be the only one in that space because it's isolating. I think it's really valuable to be able to say, well, even if I'm the only one right now, these people did come before me and they were here, even if we don't see them in media. Until now. Now you do, because you're going to listen to us talk about them.
See, and you say you're not an expert, and while you may not be like a big historian, for the most part, I've never really thought about the lack of representation of Black people when it comes to cowboys, ranchers, or hunters. And I think it's really important because if we're going to try to be more welcoming and inclusive, including in outdoor spaces and lifestyles, it is important to represent them, not just in modern times, but if they are there historically, they deserve to be represented because people take pride in heritage, and it's really hard to take pride in a heritage you don't know exists. So I think that it is really cool, the idea that there is this group of Black people that have traditionally existed in these spaces, and in bringing them to light, it could really help encourage modern and future generations of Black people to participate more in these lifestyles. So I definitely think it's worth delving into the history of these people to help not just bring to light their lost history, but to also help be more welcoming and inclusive of people who may want to participate in these lifestyles and may not feel like they belong in them because historically they've been neglected in these spaces.
Mm-hmm. And I guess my interest was sparked in this because after Black Birders Week, we had this conversation with someone at the breakfast show in Toronto. And the producer who I was talking with, he's from Alberta. And he mentioned John Ware, and I had never heard of him. So I went off on this tangent of research, looking into histories of Black folks on the prairies, because I lived in Montana, and you would not think living in Montana of like Black communities on the prairies necessarily. And what I found is that John Ware was integral to the cattle industry and the beginning of the cattle industry in Alberta, which has been such a huge part of that province's history. And even today, the Calgary Stampede is the largest outdoor show in the world. And thousands of people attend annually. And, you know, like, that culture is a huge part of Alberta's economy and Calgary's economy. And there was this Black man who was integral to the beginning of this industry in Canada. And I think that's really important to recognize that and to talk about him. And this narrative is becoming more popular. And there are children's books I have discovered. There's a children's book about John Ware. And also someone just released a documentary film for the Calgary Film Festival about his history in the province.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I'm really excited to see that. I cannot remember the name of it, but
I will definitely plug it when I find it.
Yes. When it comes out, I'm excited to see that. And so I really started looking into, you know, the history of the Black community in the American and Canadian West. And there is a place called Amber Valley in Alberta. And Amber Valley is known because for a long time, Amber Valley was a community, a Black community. It was a homesteading community in northern Alberta. And it was founded by Black folks who came from Oklahoma. Most of them moved north after the Civil War and freed slaves, and they settled in Alberta. And lots of the other settlers in Alberta were Eastern European. And then there was this like one Black community. And so I think that's really interesting that there was this community that was like completely Black. And one day, hopefully, I will visit it. But
after COVID, post-COVID vacation ideas.
Yes. And actually, after Amber Valley, the Canadian government made efforts to try and prevent the immigration of Black people from the States to Canada. It was an oversight on their part that they thought that people that would move to Canada would not be Black. And after this Black community was established in Alberta, they very quickly made efforts to prevent Negroes from coming north. And they used all sorts of ridiculous excuses. Like, oh, well, the climate is not appropriate. Which, I shouldn't laugh, but it's kind of funny. And so there is this history, but it's very clear when you're looking into it that although there are all of these Black Oklahomans who moved to Alberta and Saskatchewan and other people who moved north because of the racism and anti-Blackness in the States, they weren't necessarily welcome here either. But it's very interesting to read about it because Canadians, and I'm not trying to call out Canadians, but in Canada, there is this very pervasive idea that, oh, well, racism is an American problem. That's something that happens in the States. Like, that's not a Canadian problem, which is a big load of BS if you think about the way that Canadians treat Indigenous people in Canada. But that's a whole other podcast episode. But there's this very strange and not true opinion that is very common here that I've noticed. And people are like, you know, Canadians aren't racist. That's not our problem. And it's just crap. I'm trying really hard to be PG-13. I was reading an article the other day on this website called Black Past, which, great website if you want to understand more about hidden histories of Black folks. And in the article, which made me laugh, it says, many Canadians feel pride about their country's role in the operation of the Underground Railroad. This was written in 2009, in fairness. But I would say if you ask the average Canadian about the Underground Railroad, they would probably not know that the terminus of the Underground Railroad was what is today Ontario. And I currently live in Ontario. I previously lived in BC. And in BC, there's not... If there's Black history in BC, I don't know about it. And in Ontario, we have Carabana, which is a Caribbean festival on Emancipation Day. And there is a much larger Black community here because of Toronto. But I would still not say that people identify Ontario with the Underground Railroad. And I recently actually took myself on a field trip within my own city to visit this 700-year-old white oak tree that exists. It's now a heritage tree. And it was used as a beacon on the Underground Railroad as a meeting place for people who were escaping slavery to Canada. And it's this huge tree. Like, it's amazing that it's still standing. White oak trees usually only live 300 years. So it has outlived its life expectancy. And it's amazing to be able to visit this like living piece of history that people came here and escaped slavery and they came to this tree and like to stand there. It's really interesting. But I don't think that the actual Black history of Canada is well recognized at all. So it just made me laugh when they were like, many Canadians feel pride. I'm like,
Yeah. I imagine that topics like slavery and civil rights are taught in Canada very similar to how they're taught in the US, where we are given this very cursory amount of information that isn't really that in depth. Like, the topics aren't covered as thoroughly as they should be so that people can fully understand and contextualize what happened. And of course, you know, histories are full of their biases too. But our understanding of things like the civil rights movement, for example, have been generally misused against things like the modern protests we're having. And a big reason why people will sit there and weaponize MLK is because they don't fully understand the context of what happened back then during the movement, and they misrepresent information because they don't actually fully understand these topics. And it's really important that people read more than just their high school history books for this information, because it's not giving them the full story about what happened.
No, and I would say like one thing that I have really been interested in since Black Birders Week is this idea, both in the States and in Canada, that Black folks are urban dwelling and they're not interested in nature. A friend of mine went to a meeting recently, and in this meeting, someone said, well, you know, the reason that we don't see Black students doing field work is because they just don't want to.
Oh, God.
And I was like, really? Really? Are we still going to pretend in the year 2020 that the reason that Black students are horribly underrepresented in disciplines that require field work is because we just don't want to?
Wow, did they just like miss Black AF and STEM and all the amazing weeks we had highlighting Black scientists doing field work, like tagging sharks or collaring big cats? How did they miss all of that?
Right.
It's out there. You just have to look for like 10 seconds.
And that is one of the reasons that Black Birders Week came about, was because of this incident with Christian Cooper and this idea that a Black person being in an outdoor space like this is threatening, or like just because you're outside and you're Black is like unusual, because it's totally not. The Black community being part of the outdoor community is like completely plausible, but the problem is that the common or popular narratives that are presented to people in media and in film and in magazines are not of the Black people that are part of these communities. And it creates this idea that we don't exist there, even though we do. And it is the same way with hunting, with agriculture, especially with ranching. There is this strange idea that Black people are not connected to the land. We all live in cities. We don't like the outdoors, apparently. And it's honestly laughable, but it is a huge problem. And it also is negating this huge history of Black people on the prairies and as ranchers and Black hunters and, you know, all of these other histories that exist, like that have been forgotten. And there was this migration of African Americans from Oklahoma to the Canadian prairies. And so during this migration, approximately a thousand, I don't think they counted every single person, Black folks from Oklahoma made their way to Alberta and Saskatchewan to find a new life on the prairies. And it's very interesting when you think about the Canadian prairies today and what you think about when you think about the prairies as not Black folks. But yeah, it's really amazing to me that this history exists. And it's also kind of saddening that people still promote these same ideas of like, well, surely Black people don't like the snow. Like,
and of course, before we started recording the podcast, I had brought up my experience in Minnesota, where I had been baffled by the very large Somalian immigrant community there, thinking, how could they be comfortable in Minnesota after coming from a country that sits on the equator? Yet, despite the reservations I had, they have found a way to thrive as a community and have even elected their first official to Congress, despite a lot of the political and social obstacles they faced when they first started really coming to Minnesota.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it was an adjustment for African Americans coming north, because in Oklahoma, if you're living off the land, you can obviously grow a lot more food than you can in Canada. So the climate is a challenge in that regard. But there was also a lot of wild game. And so these settlers would have also been hunting deer and game birds and things like that. And yet, if you open a hunting magazine, you're very unlikely to see a Black hunter represented, even though Black folks have been hunting and procuring their own food from the land this entire time. But it's just not part of the popular narrative. And in a time when the number of people hunting is declining every year, and we're concerned about, you know, like, how are we going to fund wildlife management in North America because of these declining license sales, Black communities and person of color communities and Indigenous communities often have higher birth rates than white communities. And so you're looking at, like, how do we recruit more hunters? And there's these communities that are growing communities that could be hunters who you're recruiting. And yet there are all these barriers to them becoming part of the hunting community. And so that is one big reason that for part of Black Mammalogist Week, I was keen to have Forage Friday. And the whole day will be focused on the perspectives of Black folks in hunting. And we're going to have a panel where we managed to get some Black hunters. Yay. And we're going to have a panel with them and hear about their experiences being Black in the hunting community and what barriers they did face joining the hunting community, because it's very complex. It's guns. It's rural areas. It's the people who are commonly portrayed to be the hunting community. We're both pulling faces. Right. You just can't see us.
Like, we're both just making these faces like, oh, God.
Like, think about hunting and the hunting community. And you think about the people who come to mind. Then you realize why Black people might not feel necessarily welcome. And, you know, all of the hunters that I know, they are completely chill. It would never be an issue. But when you're talking about recruitment of people who have no exposure to this community to begin with, what you think about when you see the media associated with a sport is really important, and representation becomes really important. I'm lucky in that I have traveled and lived in places where hunting is very common and have friends who are part of the hunting community. So to me, I wouldn't have an issue joining the hunting community. But for someone who doesn't have that, I can totally see why you wouldn't want to go out in the forest with a bunch of men who have guns.
When you put it like that.
You know, like, when you think about it.
It's a fair point to bring up. And, you know, hunting is really missing from the sustainability dialogue. I don't personally hunt. I do try to be as vegan as possible, but when I fail to be vegan, I do try to eat locally, aka a locavore, or I also try to, whenever the opportunity presents itself, eat invasive species or invasivore. Yeah, so, I mean, technically I'm called a flexitarian, but I really just, I hate all the various titles. At the end of the day, I'm just trying to eat sustainably, and hunting is a way to be sustainable, you know, going out and getting your own food from a local source. And also it can help with wildlife management because parks do sell licenses, and part of this can be their management plan to reduce things like maybe white-tailed deer populations that may be overabundant in certain areas, but also to help fund themselves. And so when we talk about trying to help people become more sustainable, there is a distinct lack of discussion about the option for becoming a hunter.
Yeah, it's very interesting to explore these kind of hidden narratives. And so the other thing that I found out about recently was the existence of black fur traders. So I was talking to Jacqueline Scott. She is on Twitter, Black Outdoors, and she looks at the history of race in the outdoors in Canada. She's a PhD student, and she's super knowledgeable. Jacqueline was telling me about these black fur traders, and I was like, what? We had black fur traders? Who knew? The Hudson's Bay Company and like the founding of Canada as we know it relied on fur trading. And when you think of fur traders, you're like, oh yeah, French Canadians, like, you know, no, you wouldn't think of black fur traders. And the country that we now recognize as Canada was literally built on the fur trade, and black people were a part of that. And it's just so ludicrous that when you think of Canada, people think, oh yeah, like white people and French people who like settled this country and traded beaver furs with indigenous people and then became ranchers and pioneers of the West. And it's just a lot of bullshit. Sorry, children, you can bleep me out. But it's just so ridiculous. And that is also something that I have been learning about is, or trying to learn about, is the history of black folks in Canada in relation to Indigenous nations in Canada. And so that has also been really interesting, and it's really complex to learn about the relationships between Indigenous cultures in Canada and black folks who were here and black slaves that were here. I recently found out whilst looking into this that there were actually slaves in Canada as we know it today that were bought to the Atlantic provinces from the Caribbean and were slaves in Canada. When people think of slavery in North America, they're like, oh, the American South, and they like picked cotton and stuff like that. And that's not the case. We had slaves in Canada. People won't tell you about it, but we did. So it's interesting that we have this history of like, we had slaves in Canada, and there were slaves escaping the US, coming to Canada to be free. And then we also had black fur traders who were integral to the narrative that we credit with creating Canada as we know it today, which also is hugely problematic. I saw a post the other day that said, oh, let's celebrate Heritage Day. That's a hunting thing. It's a hunting day. And it was like, Canada was built on the legacy of hunting and trapping. And this is a day to celebrate that. And I like commented back in the tweet. And I was like, I think you should reword this tweet, because the reality is that Canada was built off of the stealing of land from Indigenous people and the enslavement of Black bodies. Like, you cannot pretend that the legacy of Canada and Canada as a country was built on hunting and trapping. Like, that is just, we stole hunting lands from Indigenous people and took the game that they needed to survive and like caused starvation of Indigenous people. And then we're sitting here as hunting organizations saying, oh, let's celebrate our heritage that built this country as hunters, all the while being completely oblivious to the Indigenous population and also the Black community who to this day are not represented in hunting organizations, in hunting media, in hunting magazines. It's just like ridiculous. It's 2020. Get it together, y'all.
And you're right, because it's one of those things that is so frustrating. Because when we talk about the need to address representation and lost histories like these, there are so many people who their first reaction is, oh, well, I don't want to feel guilty for things that people a long time ago did or that my ancestors did. I have no control over this, so why should I feel guilty about it?
Right.
And it's like, that's not what we're saying. We're not saying that you need to feel guilty for something that is beyond your control. However, you do need to acknowledge that these things happened. We have to acknowledge these horrible things that happened throughout history and make sure that they're not erased. And when you decide that in your pursuit of purging this imaginary guilt, you want to erase parts of history because you don't want to confront them, you should feel guilty about that. Like, it's wrong to not discuss these things.
Right. So there's a kids history magazine called Kayak. They had an edition of the magazine called How Furs Built Canada. Like, there's this real reliance on this narrative of like Hudson's Bay Company. And Hudson's Bay still exists as a store. Like, it's still a thing. To this day.
I've heard of it too, and I'm not even like in Canada.
Right. I
know what you're talking about.
And so it's so curious to me that throughout all of this, like, oh, well, fur trading is what built the Canadian nation, that no one really talks about Black fur traders. And it just kind of furthers this idea that Black people don't belong in the outdoors. It's just lots of little pieces that contribute to this stupid and pervasive idea that we are strange if you see us outside. I grew up in rural England. I lived in a village of 300 people. And we were the only Black people in our village. Me and my sister of 300 people. I don't know how that works out as a percentage. And this new mother and daughter moved to our village and they were Jamaican. And they came and knocked on our door one day and said, oh, we heard that some other Black folks lived in the village and this is where you lived. They wanted to meet the other Black people in the village because, you know, thinking that you're the only Black people is isolating. So I think it's all really important to recognize that Black people did help to build the American West. Black people like John Ware helped to build the Canadian West. And if you actually take the time to look, Black people have been part of the history of Canada and of the United States in all of these places that are now romanticized. Being a cowboy is such like a romanticized thing, which is hilarious to me because I have friends who are ranchers and it's definitely not a romantic profession. But I think it's also part of this, like,
you sound so done with this.
the people who are like, I'm trying to phrase it in a way that's like not offensive, but the people who are like, farmers are the backbone of this country, and like we as Americans and patriots must put America first and like support American farmers and ranchers, are the same people who don't believe in Black rights, often, not always, but often, right? So it's like, if you think about that and these people who are very like anti-Black rights, but very like pro-farming and ranching, as if there are no Black ranchers, as if there are no Black farmers. And I struggle to comprehend that. And it's just like this narrative has been buried so much that people who are against Black rights are like so pro-farming, as if there's no like overlap between those two things.
Yeah, and it's such a complex topic too, because if you remember a few years back when the Bundy brothers went up to Oregon and they took over that Bureau of Land Management building for like a couple of weeks. They held it hostage.
Yeah, I remember that.
Right. And recently, Amon Bundy, who was one of the people who did that, he recently came out as a supporter of Black Lives Matter. And so many people, including me, were very confused about it because of the way that political narrative works in the U.S. But when you really think about it, and he explained this, he is opposed to the government interfering in private lives. He wants like a smaller, reduced federal government doing less in the lives of private citizens and leaving them alone. And if you think about it, the police are an extension of the government. They enforce the law that, you know, is passed by government. And so if you're somebody who is more for smaller government and less interference of government in the lives of private citizens, then yeah, it makes sense to support Black Lives Matter. But at the same time, I'm sitting here trying to reconcile this because I'm still angry at him years later for what he did in Oregon. But at the same time, I can't help but feel some ounce of respect for his consistency, at least in his morality, because there are a lot of people who don't have that consistency. They will complain about the government interfering in their lives, and then they will support the issues we're seeing with police brutality and the absolute invasion of private lives and disregard of basic human rights of people of color, you know, Black people, Indigenous people, Latin people, so on. It's like, why don't you guys understand the hypocrisy of what you're saying and doing?
And it's so funny to me because, like, he's totally right. And it's funny because people are like, yeah, I'm all for the government not being involved in my business unless you're Black. Then they should be involved in your business. Or like, I'm all for gun rights unless you're a Black gun owner. Then you're a criminal and you're dangerous and you shouldn't be allowed a gun. But I, as a white person, should be allowed a gun to defend my property. What kind of nonsense? Did you take the blue pill? Like, what is going on? It's ridiculous.
Ironically, if you read a lot of their
Twitter profiles, you'll see that a lot of them are like, oh, I took the red pill in their bio. But then you start scrolling through their account and it's like, I don't think you really took the red pill. I think that you don't really understand what you're talking about.
Right. The thing is that if we want more Black hunters, you have to talk about the way that Black folks are treated within the gun owning community. Because unless you're hunting with a bow, which you could do, but rifle hunting is far more common, then you have to talk about how are Black people with guns perceived. Because it's all well and good to say like, oh, well, you could just go out hunting and take your gun and go out hunting. But when you're Black, it's not that simple.
Yeah, because we've seen how we treat little 12-year-old boys playing outside in their own neighborhood. So I can't even imagine the pressures of being a hunter, even if you have a legal gun and have your license. If you are a Black hunter in these spaces, then unfortunately, there is an inherent danger to you, and it can make those spaces really unwelcoming, even if you're doing all the right things.
Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because I think that there is, you know, people think, oh, well, Black people don't go out and hunt, and Black people don't ranch, and Black people don't do this, and Black people don't do that, or whatever. But Black people who did migrate to the prairies faced huge amounts of racism and were very not welcome in those spaces. And, you know, there's also, it's not really something that I can talk about, but there's also becoming a lot of recognition of Afro-Indigenous people and how our communities are intertwined and our shared history of fighting against colonialism. And also, I have heard stories about this and I would like to hear more about it, but I don't know enough. I wish I learned more. But a lot of slaves, when they were escaping slavery and when they were going on the Underground Railroad and they were participating in slave revolts, Harriet Tubman had to have been an incredible naturalist and outdoors woman to be able to help people escape slavery under the cover of darkness and make it to Canada. And so you have this woman who's a huge part of our history, and then people say, well, Black people just don't like the outdoors. Maybe think about why you're making that statement. Or like, why would Black people potentially not like the outdoors? It's not because they literally don't like the outdoors. It's because of all the other things that come with being outdoors. The staring, the blatant racism, the history of lynchings in America, and then it becomes a very intertwined issue. You can't really talk about being Black outdoors without talking about the historical wrongdoings against the Black community. So they are intertwined. Also, Native Americans were a huge part of Black slaves escaping slavery. Native Americans helped people who were escaping, because if you're a slave and you're just escaping, that's a huge task. And so some of those slaves that did escape then became part of Native American communities, or Native Americans helped them and showed them, you know, like, this is what you should forage, or this is what you should hunt in this area. And they shared their knowledge of living on the land with these people who were escaping slavery. And the only way that escaped slaves survived was by living on the land. And yet in the year 2020, the narrative is that the outdoors is very white. When you look at the marketing of outdoor brands, Big Agnes, cough, cough.
Kylie Jenner's new hiking attire. Your face. Your face was everybody's reaction to that post. I love that you bring that up, though, especially the idea, I'd never really thought of that, but it makes sense, the idea that Harriet Tubman would have had to have really strong connections to nature and have naturalist background, because back then, the Eastern cougar still existed. We still had red wolves, so there were large mammalian carnivores, mm-hmm, all along that region. And if they were especially moving at night, which is when most cougars hunt, you know, you had to be very conscientious. You had to understand nature and understand how to stay safe in natural spaces, which would require you to have knowledge and connections to nature. So, you know, that's a really incredible thing to bring up, because I doubt most people do really consider the fact that, you know, there was no nice paved road or actual tunnel. They were out in wild spaces moving north in very dangerous places. And they had to have those very important connections to stay safe and to get to the places where they could potentially thrive. And that's a really cool thing to bring up, because now I wonder if anybody's ever written from that perspective of how Black people had to have just very basic naturalist understandings of nature in order to survive and be somewhat successful anywhere, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting to see the portrayal of the outdoors. And then when you look at the history of like the outdoors, such very different things. And especially, I know, like you were saying, that you're from the South. And when, like in South Carolina, there is historical records of, I'm looking at it right now, of the first recorded slave revolt with the aid of Native Americans was in 1526 in what is now South Carolina, in a Spanish settlement. And 100 slaves revolted against 500 Spaniards after nearby Native Americans became hostile to the settlement. And then the slaves who escaped became integrated into that Native American community after they got rid of the Spaniards. They shared a common goal of defeating the Europeans. And even today, the Black community and the Indigenous community share a lot of similarities in our struggles against colonialism and racism, and our communities have suffered socioeconomic consequences for like 200 years, even though slavery is gone, and even longer for Native Americans. So this whole thing of ranching and hunting and just being in the outdoors, and that Black people don't belong there, discredits this very long history of Black people not only being in these spaces, but being successful. John Ware was hugely successful. And Joseph Lewis was a Black fur trader, and he was hugely successful as a Black fur trader. And people don't talk about it. And it was the same thing, you know, when I went to school in England, that people only talk about the winning side, right? Or what they perceive to be the winning side, and they forget about all of these other things. But I think it's really important when we're now trying to increase representation in the outdoors and increase the diversity in the hunting community, that we look back to the history of like the people who did this before us and who did exist and who were integral to the histories that we live today. And their names aren't necessarily recorded, but they existed. So it's really interesting to me to learn more about that as I'm trying to explain to outdoor recreation companies why diversity is important, or how do we get more Black people into Canadian parks? Tell them about the history of the Black people who were here before them. Hire Black staff. That's a really big one in all of these talks I've had with lots of different organizations, whether it be a conservation organization, whether it be a hunting organization, whether it be Patagonia. That is one of the biggest things, is like hire Black staff. Because even if you put Black models in your magazines or in your advertising, people are not going to want to come to your store when your store is just full of non-diverse people. Why would they be comfortable doing that? You know, and that's the thing, is that all of these things are intertwined. Listeners are probably like, why is this even relevant to us? But hunting and conservation are completely intertwined, and protected areas and conservation are completely intertwined. And so whether Black people feel comfortable visiting parks or going outdoors or see themselves represented in the branding for Marmot, it is all interconnected. I guess in some ways it's like an ecology, because all the parts are connected to each other. And if we want to fund conservation and we want to have people visiting parks in 20 years, we cannot continue to keep excluding this whole group of people. It just isn't going to work. And so I think it's really important that we recognize that and we do something to rectify it. And I think a big part of that is looking backwards to look forwards and recognizing that, like, Black people in the outdoors isn't a new concept. Black people hunting is not a new concept. Black people ranching is not a new concept. Just because you've forgotten about it doesn't mean it didn't happen.
And we're going to go ahead and pause right there. So we go on for another hour or so after this. So I'm breaking up the episode, like I said, and I'm going to release the other one this Friday. So be sure to keep an eye out for part two of Rhiannon's Takeover. But I hope that everybody really came away with the message that she really reinforced throughout this entire narrative of neglecting representation of Black people and just in general, like the Black, Indigenous, and people of color community in outdoor spaces, to also ensure that they feel welcome in those spaces despite the stereotypes against them. So it's something that I think a lot of people have been thinking about lately with all the discussions we've been having around social justice issues, and it's worth thinking about. So she dropped a lot of names and references throughout the episode. One that you heard a lot was John Ware. And so if you are interested in looking him up, his name is spelled J-O-H-N-W-A-R-E. She also discussed Joseph Lewis, and you can do the same if you Google him. I typically, especially since there could be a lot of Joseph Lewis's in the world, I added Black Fur Trader when I did a Google search of him. So his name's spelled the way it sounds. So J-O-S-E-P-H-L-E-W-I-S. And then she also mentioned the website Black Past. And so I looked that up. It is blackpast.org. And it is dedicated to not just African Americans, but also African heritage in general, whether it's in different countries or in Africa itself. So it's basically kind of like a Black Wikipedia. It's really cool. It's got a lot of articles. Some of them are focusing on individuals. In other cases, it's focusing on history and culture. I really had a great time going through it, especially the cuisine part, because I love exploring different cultural cuisines. And this actually has some really cool articles discussing things like how food traditions migrated with Africans to other places through things like the transatlantic slave trade and the influences that it has on our modern foods. And so that was a really interesting read. So if that's something you're interested in, I definitely recommend it. It was a really cool site to visit and had a lot of really great resources. Also, if you aren't following them, make sure that you check out Black Mammalogist Week, which is going on right now. We're halfway through the week, and each day has different themes. So today is We Out Here. So be sure to check that out. There's been some really great content. It's been really cool seeing some of the information about field work that people did. I read some really cool stuff about the art of tagging and collaring species for science. And I'm sure that anybody who takes the time to look will learn something cool too. But anyway, that's a wrap for this. Thank you all so much for listening in on this. And for any questions or comments, you can feel free to reach out to me at my email, thenaturalist@thenaggingnaturalist.com. And you can check out my website, thenaggingnaturalist.com. And on social media, you can find me under The Nagging Naturalist on Facebook and Instagram, as well as on Twitter under the handle @nag_naturalist. You can also help out my podcast by leaving reviews on either Apple Podcast or podchaser.com to help kind of spread the word and give me a little bit more visibility. If you love learning about wildlife and don't want to wait for another episode, check out some of these other really awesome wildlife podcasts. All Creatures Podcast, Crittercast, The Wildlife, Just the Zoo of Us, Animals to the Max, Varmints, Amazing Wildlife Podcast, The Casual Birder, The What Are You Podcast, The Songbirding Podcast, and Strange Animals Podcast, which are all safe for work. There's also Keeper Chat, which is an amazing podcast, but it is definitely not safe for work. I'm also trying to be more supportive of other non-wildlife podcasts, or at least ones that may not necessarily focus on wildlife. So here are some really great science podcasts that you can check out that discuss either other types of specific sciences or just focus on science in general. Petri Dish, Planthropology, Bald Scientist, Dear Grad Student, Better Than Human, Curiosity Cake, Mad Scientist, What Are You Going to Do With That? Papa PhD, Breaking Math, Curiosity Killed the Rat, That's What I Call Science, and The Scientist Podcast, and that's scientist with two T's at the end. Some of these podcasts are and aren't safe for work, so be sure to double check if that's something of concern. I can definitely tell you Petri Dish is never safe for work unless you have a really awesome job, if I'm being honest. But I'm also on a non-wildlife podcast called The Legend of Portalcast, which discuss the world of Avatar the Last and Airbender and Legend of Korra. So you can check that out as well if that's of interest to you. Anyway, I'll be back on Friday with more from Rhiannon's Takeover. Thanks so much for listening.